Welcome back to KSCJ Radio, 1360 AM, 94.9 FM in Sioux City, Iowa. I'm Brian Bukalskis, and this is Having Read That, conversations with authors about their books.
And I am joined by the New York Times bestselling author Lawrence Lamer, who is out with a brand new book, Warhol's Muses, The Artists, Misfits, and Superstars Destroyed by the Factory Fame Machine. The book is available everywhere. Lawrence, we've had you on before talking about Capote's Women and other books that you've written, and you always find these nuggets of history that are, I don't know that they're forgotten because you still find them, but nonetheless, they're just not as popular as the popular history. And when I read your books, I think about our view of history as Americans, and you think about the 60s, and the first thing that comes to mind is Vietnam War, protests, all of that stuff. But as you look back, there was a lot of other stuff going on. So this particular story, Andy Warhol, before I read your book, I didn't know he was more than a painter. I knew the paintings that sold, that's what gets popularized. But can you set this up for us about the factory and Warhol at that time in New York City?
Well, the 60s was this decade of radical cultural and social change, unlike anything in our history, okay? And Andy Warhol was one of the central figures in that. He was an artist, but he was a cultural figure. He was a very shrewd cultural figure. And he had this studio called The Factory, where all these people showed up. I mean, my book begins early on, there's a party, it's 1964, and there's a United States senator, there are celebrities, there's members of the social elite from the East Side. I mean, 5 years before, in the late, nobody would have come. Why would they have come to a place like this? But the whole establishment was breaking down, and people were looking for different avenues, and Andy in some ways provided that. And these women that I write about in the book, these 10 women as superstars, I mean, several of them were from very wealthy families, but they just wanted out of their world. They wanted a new world, and they went into his world, and most of them ended up not very well. There was lots of drugs and excess and a very troubled time. But that's what the rush for freedom sometimes ends.
Well, and I know it's not a true comparison, but as I read it and I read about a lot of these girls that became his muses, they reminded me a lot of the Manson girls, came from really good families, successful families, and yet got hooked up and things went south from then. Is there any type of comparison between those two situations?
Well, I wish I had thought. I hate to tell you, that's a good comparison. They're just looking for something, and here's somebody who could take advantage of it. I mean, Andy was not terrible. He's not an evil person the way Manson was, but he certainly took advantage of them.
So as he's making his movies, finding these women, would Andy Warhol have been Andy Warhol without the women?
Well, no. He's called himself an ugly gay man. That's not me calling him that. That's like what he called himself. In the early 60s, contemporary art, there maybe were 1,000 people in America that bought it, okay? And he couldn't sell his art. To sell his art, he had to get into the homes of the elite. He wouldn't get there by himself. In the arm of a beautiful woman who came from social background, he could get there and ingratiate himself with these people and sell his paintings, and that's what he did.
And his paintings, this pop art, what was it that drove the idea of pop art? Because we're talking about Campbell's soup cans, those types of things, all the famous paintings, and then his portraits. But was there something driving the market other than having a beautiful woman on his arm?
Well, no. He was anti-fine art. He took these industrial things, like in literature for that matter, and turned them into anti-art. It was art against the establishment. And what did he do, really? His art, he only made it for about 5 years in the first half of the 60s. And what would he do? He'd take a picture, maybe taking a picture of an electric chair, or Elizabeth Taylor, for that matter, a publicity still, and he'd use silkscreen process to expand it, make it much larger, and he would colorize it. And it took maybe 2 hours, and that was his art. And then the portrait of Elizabeth Taylor in 2022 sold for $195 million, and he may not even have painted that. His assistant may have done that. And paint is probably, I have quotes around the word paint.
The factory, it was different locations around New York City, but where was it primarily located?
Well, this is on 47th Street, but that's the famous location. It was a kind of grungy space. You took a service elevator up to it, and there it was. It was painted silver. The walls were silver, but those started peeling. So it wasn't a terribly appealing place, but that was the place to be. And all kinds of famous people and artists and creative people showed up there.
When you go through the different stories of his muses, they're not famous names, but as you tried to dig into the research, what's that research like 50, 60 years later as you're trying to do that? Is it an easy task to find out about, or do you have to dig way deep?
I got lucky. And to do what I do, you got to get lucky if you can have new material. I'm lucky in two places. There's a woman called Jean Stein, who's an heiress, and she wanted to write a book about Edie Sedgwick. Edie Sedgwick is in the cover of my book, and she's the most famous of the muses. And so she spent 5 years. She went all over the United States, a lot of money. She recorded her interviews and had somebody, had people transcribe them. And she couldn't finish it, and George Plimpton turned it into an oral history. It's one of the great works of the 60s. And those documents sit in the New York Public Library. So I spent a week going, just incredible trove of material for my book. Second thing is, Andy Warhol, from 1966 on, when the first cassette players came out, started recording everything. By the time he got up in the morning, he'd record. If he was in a taxi cab, he'd record. If he was having dinner with you, he'd be recording you, and he wouldn't be telling you. So there are 3,400 tapes sitting at the Warhol Foundation in New York, and it's been only 40 years, and they don't want anybody to hear these because of the stuff that's on them. But the archivist for the museum, the Warhol Museum, is in Pittsburgh. And I was there kind of feeling kind of despondent. How was I going to get material? And Matt Gray, the archivist, points to this table, and there are all these boxes with the transcripts for the period of my book. So what could be better than that? What could be more intimate than that, than the transcripts of just what went on?
I'm chatting with Lawrence Lamer about his brand new book, Warhol's Muses, The Artists, Misfits, and Superstars Destroyed by the Factory Fame Machine. The book's available everywhere. Lawrence, did Andy Warhol view these women as muses in real time?
He used people, okay? He always kept a distance from everything. He was a voyeur. Early on, he goes to this orgy in Greenwich Village, and he just stands back watching. And somebody says, "You've got to participate or leave," and he left. But he was a voyeur. He was out on the edge of everything. This guy, Hetko, he was a dancer, and kind of disturbed. And one night he went to this place, apartment in Greenwich Village, and jumped out the window. And Andy's response was, "Gee, I wish I'd been there. I would have liked to have filmed it." And that was his strange attitude, so emotionally distanced from everyone and everything.
You live in the East Coast now. You've got Iowa roots. I know you wrote for a paper in What Cheer, but even more local than that, you got relatives from around here, right?
Do I ever? I've got a great uncle who I think he died about 4 years ago. He was a lawyer, a prominent lawyer in South Sicily. In fact, my brother's a lawyer, and he's such a great family. He invited my brother out to join his law firm. My brother didn't do it. He's in New Jersey. But I've been all through that. I've been to the farms. We've got, for generations, we're farmers. My grandfather, there are five brothers there in Nebraska, right across the line. They all went to the University of Nebraska. Four of them ended up went back being farmers, and my grandfather became an educator.
And I thought it was interesting that you were in What Cheer, because I'd never heard of that city. It's a small town on in between here and Des Moines along I-80, but I remember there was a major bank robbery there 20, 25 years ago or whatever it was, and so I didn't even hear of the town until it became a national news story. So tell me about your time in What Cheer.
Well, I just lived all over the world, and that was one of the strangest. I ruined myself socially the very first night. I was living in the up above the newspaper offices, up down on the main street. And I thought I'd go and get a beer, so I went to the tavern and got a beer. And I didn't realize that nobody of any substance in town went to the tavern, and only the drunks went to the tavern. And people drank heavily in town, but there's a state liquor store. But you didn't go to the state liquor store in your town. There, you went somewhere else, and they went to your town. You kind of hide that. So that, but the people were great to me. I had a terrific time. It was a fascinating experience.
Your journalistic career, how did that influence your writing career with books? Are there still things that you learned as a cub reporter that you still use as you research a book-length piece?
I mean, everything is learning. No, not just for writing. That's just part of it. We learn, you know, we learn constantly. We don't even know. I don't even know where some of my ideas come from, but they come from all kinds of experiences.
When you take a topic like Andy Warhol, I would think that, especially on the East Coast, he was famous there. Was he nationwide famous in his day? Because it seems like everybody in the world knows who he is now.
Oh yeah, he's the most famous. He's the most famous artist in the world, bar none. He's it. Everybody knows Andy Warhol. And I wrote a book about Truman Capote. Believe me, a lot of people don't know Truman Capote any longer, but they sure as heck know Andy Warhol.
The women that you cover in this book, they've got to have relatives, and so as their generations have gone on, is this surprising news to people who realize that they had a relative that was involved in this?
With Andy Warhol?
Right.
Well, they know it, and you know the veneer of fantasy comes over this stuff, and that's what my book does, is exposes that veneer. Okay, and a lot of people aren't going to be happy about that, but it's the truth because it's totally documented.
There's so many famous names that turn up in your book. Leonard Cohen was one, and it seems like as I think back to the people that I know from that era, it's like, that would make sense that was where it is. But we talk about 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon now. Was it almost 6 degrees of Andy Warhol for anybody of any celebrity at the time?
Well, you know, I was flying to L.A. a couple of weeks ago, and I watched the Bob Dylan film, which is a terrific film. And Dylan is part of it. Dylan went out. Two of the people in my book, Edie Sedgwick, she had an involvement with him, and Nico is another superstar, who was a singer. Nico was in Paris just before walking in the street, just before Dylan became famous, and she meets him on the street, and they go off and have an affair in Greece. So, all these people float through that world.
As you float through the world now from a literary perspective, I don't know if you've written about him in the past. This is the first thing I've read that you wrote about him. But are there certain people that write about Warhol? Is it now part of a small community? Same with the people that write about Capote, about Hitchcock, anything like that?
Are there famous people that do that? Or
as far as writers, when you cover a topic now, are you among the people that write about Warhol and chat about him among other writers?
You know, I'm now known as this person who writes about the rich and the famous. Doesn't make me too happy to be called that, because I've had a long career and I've written all different kinds of books, but I guess that's what I'm doing now.
It had an element of Dominic Dunn to me as far as reading your books. I think about it, about when the books that you write about rich and elite. You hate to get pigeonholed by that way, but you seem to have a knack for it. Is that kind of how it feels to you?
Well, Dominic Dunn was a friend of mine. That's not a bad pigeonhole, let me tell you.
All right. Well, the book is called Warhol's Muses, The Artists, Misfits, and Superstars Destroyed by the Factory Fame Machine. It is by Lawrence Lamer. The book's available everywhere. Lawrence, just a fantastic book written by somebody with connections to our little town here. So thank you very much for joining us to talk about it.
Thanks for having me.
This has been Having Read That on KSCJ Radio. I'm Brian Vakulskas. Check out all of our episodes on our website, kscj.com, and subscribe to our iTunes podcast. Thanks to music historian Molly Jolly and segment producer John Weisler. We will be back next time. Andy Warhol, let's scream, hang him on.